Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And it's Kate.
And this is Med Crimes. But I'm always dancing. Have you noticed that?
Always dancing. You're always bopping. I actually had to tell her one time, like, I can hear the fabric rustling when you do that. It's messing up our recordings. Please try not to jive so hard in our own intro music. What's up, guys?
Hi, everyone. We're back.
It is still January, which I feel like is just the longest effing month.
Always
of the year. It's
cold,
ridiculous.
Everybody's sick. Everybody's tired.
I know. It's awful. Also, there are our kids running around upstairs
again. There are four children upstairs. Mm-hmm. So if you hear the loud pitter patter,
we're sorry. We're in a basement.
Escaped. Dad's in charge.
Yes.
It's a good day. Here we are. So Kate and I were just talking about the good week we've had.
Oh, yeah, we've had an amazing week.
Should we give her the shout out first.
Okay, so
this girl, very wise, she snatched up spot number 5.
Patreon 5.
I said last week that slot this was filled. Like the golden spot, and someone had to snatch it up.
Girl, you are my personal hero. Your name is Emily Taylor. Thank you so much. Also, she did disclose to me that she is a healthcare worker.
Yay!
And that she likes to listen to us when she's, you know, doing the stuff that she needs to do, which is amazing.
Yes.
And we are so incredibly lucky to have you as part of our squad.
Oh, we are so thankful for your support.
We really are.
And even if you're not a Patreon, everybody that's out there that's listening, everybody that's out there that's giving us reviews, we are so appreciative of your support. We're on what, episode 9?
Episode 9.
I mean, like I said many podcasts ago, these are the early days, but I never thought when Kate asked me to do a podcast, like, I just thought I got to hang out with you. So I never thought that it was going to, like, do this. And since we're starting to get support from people out in gosh knows where.
Yes. And some feedback, amazing. Some good feedback.
Yes. We love your feedback, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kate was just telling me about.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, you know what? We so appreciate the feedback. And sometimes when we're just talking, things roll off the tongue.
Yes.
We never mean to be offensive.
Yes.
But to bring something to light, how do you want
to... So we have somebody gave us some feedback, which I was so appreciative of, because I didn't even realize that one of us said it. And I don't know when it was said. I think it was back in like episode either 3 or 4 or 5, rather, Janine Jones episode, that apparently we accidentally referred to EMS personnel as ambulance drivers, or used the term ambulance driver, which I honestly, neither of us consider EMS personnel to be just ambulance drivers.
Absolutely not.
Trust me, it is an entirely different world. It is an incredible specialty, and it's insane.
I personally have to, I am so thankful for the EMS personnel that's in my town.
Yes.
When my son was born, I was brought to the hospital from our EMS. I was 36 weeks and right down to the dispatcher. They kept my husband and I so calm. The EMS that came to our house, checking me out, making sure all was good, and helping me with everything that I needed in the ambulance. You guys know your stuff. And we are so thankful. From whether you're a paid personnel, whether you're a volunteer, anyone that's in the EMS field, you guys are wonderful.
It is such an incredible and just absolutely bonkers environment that you guys work in, and especially now. I'll tell you, I work in an inpatient environment, so I sometimes, you know, have to participate in code situations. And even in my situation, when I have the patient's full medical history, IV access, all of the equipment, all of the medications, everything that I could possibly need,
and a known
labs,
environment,
imaging, colleagues to help me, it is a chaotic, stressful thing to have to do. So the care that you guys provide in the pre-hospital environment without many of those resources, it's just mind-blowing that anyone anyone's even able to work under those very stressful conditions. So we thank you. We love you.
Absolutely. Thank you to any first responder out there, EMS, police, fire, all of you. You do amazing things. You never know what you're going to walk into.
You literally don't. It could literally be anything.
And we are living in a very strange time. And
yes.
Thank you so much. And also thank you for giving us that feedback, because we never want to make it seem like we're disrespecting anybody or downplaying anybody.
Exactly. And we're going to be a lot more mindful. Exactly. We're going to be mindful in the future. And this person gave us feedback in like a polite way. Like,
we loved it.
This is great.
Thank you so much.
That's exactly what we need. And please, we keep it coming, guys, because we
love it. We want to grow and we want to grow in a respectful way.
Exactly.
We want to grow in a healthy way, I guess, as far as, you know, everything that we're learning. Mm-hmm. So it was fantastic. Thank
you. Yes, it was awesome.
We've gotten some great feedback from our reviewers and other people that are listening. So it's been wonderful.
It has. Continue, please, to rate also. If you listen, just take a second and just give us, you know, whatever rating you think that we deserve.
Our pages are starting to grow.
Yes, they are.
You can
social
like
media.
And follow our pages.
Like, follow all of that stuff, again, makes us more discoverable. So that's all really helpful if you guys could.
I kind of really like when I'm getting the notifications on my phone that we have, like,
I get so excited.
Like, or a new supporter, and I'm like, I have no idea who you are, and this is amazing.
Yes. Every time we get a new follower or like a new like, I always do like, this is gonna sound awful, but I do like creep on who it is, and I'm like, ooh, somebody likes us, and I get like really excited.
Yes.
So please keep it coming. And again, if Devin or I like say something that's sort of, you know, rubbed you the wrong way, or nine times out of ten, it's because our heads, our thoughts are spinning so fast when we're together and talking about this stuff, because there's so much going on that we feel like we need to cover. And sometimes things just come out. And
then we go, whoops.
And then, like, in retrospect, it's like we listen back and we're like, oh, I should edit that out. Like, that didn't sound very good.
We've had a few of those.
So, more than a few. So again, thank you for that feedback. And Emily Taylor, you're mine and Devin's personal hero, because you're Patreon number 5. Fingers snaps.
So because of that, Kate and I are going to do a separate video on our social media pages so that you guys can see us, and we'll chat with you and whatnot. But we're going to do a giveaway. We reached the golden number 5.
5.
All you people out there, like, it's 5. What?
5. Hey, you guys, excited. 5 is a milestone.
So we'll give more details about that later. So look out for that.
Hell yeah.
So I think it's time that we get going into this.
I think so too.
Med crime.
All right. So
I've also just been really looking at new topics that are going to be coming up, and I've started to find some interesting ones. So you'll hear more from me soon.
The problem is
the days that I don't work, I have my children, and they're in the 24/7 supervision phase. So
the good news is for us that there's literally no shortage of any of this content.
I know. I just Googled some and then just added the word stories at the end of it. And I just got a whole bunch. So we'll get you some good stuff.
Oh, hell yeah. There's more like really interesting stuff coming down the pike.
And if I know we did this one based on a Patreon pick.
Yes.
But if there's also stories that you want to hear, if there's some that you know, shoot us some suggestions and we'll look them up. So that would be awesome too.
Yes.
We'd love that.
And our Patreons are going to continue to get to like do these little votes and these little things.
I think
and
it's fun.
Yeah, it's super fun, dude.
Because then we get to know what you guys want to hear and not just, you know, what we think might be cool.
Exactly. It's always great to have that feedback, because we like to know.
Stomping upstairs is insane.
Oh yeah. So if you guys can hear that thumping, those are our animals, our furry little creatures running around. Furry little creatures.
All right, what do we have?
Okay, so today is our Dastardly Dentist Patreon pick.
Dastardly?
Yes,
not
I felt
bastardly.
Like...
Dastardly. Because, I mean, I feel like I'll be calling him a bastard by the end of this.
He is a bastard. So okay. I will say, Devin, you were like a little shell-shocked by last week's episode.
So this
is far less gory, less disturbing, but...
The live autopsy last week got me. I mean, anybody else?
Oh, shrieked.
As soon as you
left it in there because it was so striking. Okay, so thank you, Patreons, for your participation in having us select this guy. So we are going to be talking today about Glennon Engelman, and he is an American dentist who planned and carried out at least 5 contract killings over the span of 30 years.
Contract killings?
Yeah, contract killings.
So he was paid.
Literally was a hitman. I know. I told you it was...
Dentists make good money.
Well...
Why do you need a side gig?
Well, we're going to learn a little bit more about him.
And I always have to ask these questions.
He also manipulated multiple women in his life into assisting him and planning and executing all of these murders, all for personal and financial gain. Mm. I know. It's an interesting story.
Bastardly.
Bastardly. Yes. Okay. So Glennon Edward Engelman, he was born in February of 1927. His birthday was February 6th of 1927, and he was born in St. Louis, Missouri. He was the youngest of four children born to a working class family.
And I notice, isn't there a pattern where these people are toward the youngest of their siblings? I feel like we've always said youngest.
I feel like a lot of times we do.
We have. I wonder if it's a younger child thing.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I'm a younger child, but I don't kill people. That's true. Yep.
I have middle child syndrome. You have middle child syndrome.
So, now around this time, St. Louis in general was very much like a blue-collar working community, and so his family were, you know, just fit right into that. And academically, he did very well through school. He wasn't by any means a straight A student, but he did well. He did struggle to make friends. And once he graduated from high school, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. And after doing 4 years in the Army, he completed undergraduate studies and then entered dental school at Washington University in St. Louis, nice. From which he graduated in 1954.
Respectable.
Yeah, I think so. And so, again, there are some of these people, you know, I wish I had a little bit more about their childhood. He's one of these people that I really just don't have a lot of information. There's not a lot of information to be had about, like, his childhood and how things were. Sometimes we just don't get that stuff.
Almost 100 years ago.
And well, yeah.
Then, yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on who's written about them. And
exactly.
Not everybody's
exactly.
going to do a whole big biography on these people.
Exactly. So, now, once he was out of school, he was in debt from school. And
as
he was, anybody out there, Ray, please raise your hand. Me and Devin, by the way, have our hands in the ceiling. He was desperate for money, as all of us are, that owe a lot for, student loans. Opened a dental office in St. Louis, where he grew up. And he was initially, like, very well respected, and he often, he started to build, like, a decent clientele there of, like, some, you know, working class, but like upper middle class families were coming to see him. And for a few years, things were going really well, and he was making quite a bit of money. People who described him said that he was a known womanizer, and they all thought that he seemed nice, though, and he was really well loved. People say that he was just like magnetic with women. Like, he wasn't even that good looking. Like, if you look at the picture, did you see the pictures I posted on social media?
Yeah.
Like, nah. No, not. Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, not terrible, but also like womanizer. I don't feel like
so. You're but not a 10, dude.
Exactly. But this guy, we're gonna see how manipulative he is, and he just was able to just talk his way into and out of any situation that he desired, and into the pants of literally any woman that he wanted. It was pretty insane. He was also, I know, right? He loved money. Everybody knew him to love money and talk about money. And he was soft-spoken. He tended to really, like, chat up his patients. And he just, like, made everyone love him. Love him. And he blended in really, really well.
It's so interesting because apparently if he didn't have a lot of friends in high school, like, so that changed fast.
We're going to talk about why.
Like,
we're going to talk
years,
about it.
Like, that just changed.
We're going to talk about it.
Right.
We're going to talk about it at the end, but we're going to talk about it. Around this time, if anyone remembers, like, the news back then, which Devin and I were not born yet.
No,
so we
were
I did not.
Not
know about this until I read this story. Wow. But around this time in St. Louis, there was the city was just an utter turmoil because there were two rival mafia families in the city, and they were at an all-out war. And there were headlines around this time that described, like, there were just, I mean, daily car bombings, shootings, violence
so
in the streets.
Like doing their war across the city.
Oh, literal war. Like, people were just getting, like, shot in the streets. And, like I said, bombs were going off. Like, that. Just the city was just totally unsafe. And actually, it earned the nickname around this time as the murder capital of the world.
Really?
St. Louis, Missouri. Really? Murder capital of the world. So, that was a thing that was going on back then. And then, so as a result, the people that could financially do so all decided to sort of just up and leave the area. And that included a huge chunk of Glennon's clientele. Because remember, he was like in the middle class, upper middle class people. Right. Now, the people that were left in St. Louis ended up being the people that were lower class.
All right, now
poor.
I see why you needed money.
Yeah. Initially,
thanks, Mafia.
I know. Initially, he was charitable. He tried to be charitable at times, and he did provide a lot of free dental work to people in the area who just did not have a choice and really just needed it. So there were times when he, you know, was really donating his time. And the problem was, though, the money wasn't coming in because he didn't have the clientele to be able to fund, you know, everything that he needed to. So without any paying customers, his business kind of hopped on the struggle bus. And he couldn't afford to pay his suppliers. And he started owing others money left and right. He was borrowing $1,000 here, $1,000 there. And he was taking out loans all to just like get supplies and to like keep his practice open, essentially. Right. Now,
it takes money to make money.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, small businesses, you know, a lot of businesses, this happened to a lot of businesses in the area at the time for the exact same reason. The clientele just disappeared. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people lost their businesses. So he had an associate by the name of Sophie Barrera, and Sophie had some money in her family, and he talked her into loaning him $14,000 to assist in keeping his practice open, spinning it as like an investment. You invest, you're going to get return plus blah, blah, blah,
it's a good
percentage.
Chunk of change for the
50s. Oh, for the 50s, it's a lot. Now, he promised to pay it back in installments and to give her, you know, some interest back and that this would be an investment and she was going to start making some money. But of course, you know, the money just never started coming back in. So he wasn't ever able to really start making those payments. Now, again, he was charitable with these people when they were in need and he helped people out. He made donations to charities and he gave, you know, if there was like a young person in the community, like a teenager, he'd be like, hey, you can come sweep my floors. I'll give you $20. Like he really was like trying to, you know, keep his reputation as like this good guy that everyone really likes.
Right.
And then also, though, in the same vein, he would also, like, if there was, like, a young, like, destitute woman who was, like, homeless, he'd be like, you can come stay with me. And he would, like, take in that woman
that's
to,
not creepy at all.
Which was creepy. And that was all, like, very creepy. Sexually motivated, apparently.
Ew.
Yeah. So every favor he did, though, he typically expected, like, he wanted to get something out of it. So, like, all of this charity, all of this, like, charity stuff and this, like, image he's putting out there is all for personal gain.
Right.
Like, he wants,
or whatever.
He just wants people to, like, see him as this figure. He wants this reputation, right? So, his charitable nature started to piss off Sophie Barrera, who's the lady that lent him all this money, because she's like, yo, you're not doing a whole lot to like try to save money around here. You're
just
like handing out free dental care. Mm-hmm. You're giving like some stuff to charity. She's like, I mean, like, I'm not shaking a stick at charity, but also where's my damn money?
As an investor.
Like, what the hell? And she didn't feel like he was just trying hard enough to save money and tighten the belt and do what he needed to do. So because she was owed all that money, she felt like, you know, he really just wasn't making the effort to start paying her back. So she started getting, like, really irate and really pissed off about
Good
the whole
her.
Situation. Now, in his office, there was a young dental assistant by the name of Carmen. And Carmen is a girl that he actually knew since she was very, very young. Apparently, he and his parents were good friends with her parents, and they sort of, you know, she kind of grew up around Glenn. Mm-hmm. And when she came of age around age 20 and she didn't really know what to do with her life, he was like, hey, why don't you come work in my office? I'll train you as a dental assistant. You can find gainful employment everywhere, you know? So she was like, okay, I mean, that sounds good. Now, the two, you know, had obviously known each other forever and, like, were close, like, inherently close. And then the two, like, just worked together for, like, a number of years after this. And Glenn, around, you know, shortly after, met and married Edna Ruth Ball, who was a student that was studying to become a teacher. And she went by Ruth. She went by the name Ruth. So at first things went okay, but the marriage didn't last too long. And a lot of the reason, I guess, was the relationship between Glenn and Carmen. Because there were times...
I was going to say, was there something actually going on? Was Ruth just worried about that?
So Ruth would, like, come to the office and she would, like, open a door and the two, you know, he was, like, showing her, like, how to, you know, handle standing an instrument. Like, standing really close. And they were just always together, always behind closed doors. And she was like, I don't know what this is. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. And, I mean... It took 3 years for her to be like, listen, this is sketch and I don't like it. So after 3 years, they did get divorced. There was kind of a weird dynamic there after the divorce because he continued to support her financially and he would continue to provide her with dental care. And also they continued to have sex here and there. So basically they were still married, so just not living in the same house.
We have a certificate of divorce.
Yeah.
You were still going to do it in the bedroom.
Yep.
You're still going to clean my mouth.
Yep.
And
you're still going to clean my mouth.
And you're going to pay me.
Yeah.
Every month.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Sounds legit.
All right.
Seems legit. I know.
I'm confused.
It's all very. I'm telling you, the chaotic. I used that word for a reason, Devin. There's so much chaotic energy.
Well, somebody needs to teach Ruth about a clean break.
I feel like, yes, Ruth needs some lessons mm-hmm. about a clean break. So, during this time, after they kind of officially broke it off, and probably during the marriage also, I'm just speculating there, but he kind of just gives me that vibe. He had a lot of, like, brief affairs and relationships, and this other woman named Ruth. So, this is Ruth number two. He and Ruth number two get married. This is wife number two, also Ruth number two. Her name was Ruth Jolly. Jolly was her maiden name. Yes. Oh. No, there's not. There's not a third Ruth. There's only two Ruths. Now, these two were married for a lot of years, and we're going to talk about sort of like the course of their relationship. And she also was jealous of the dynamic between Glenn and Carmen in the dental office.
Carmen really gets herself in between some marriages.
She does. She does. Carmen is pissing off some Ruths. Dr. Glennon Engelman was known for manipulating women into assisting him with whatever it is that he needed assisting with. So... In 1976, with Glenn's encouragement, Carmen goes out and she meets a man and she goes out with a man named Peter Holm. And the two of them hit it off. And this whole time, you know, her and Glenn stay close, you know, as friends or acquaintances
so
or whatnot.
Peter jealous?
Peter. Peter is like blissfully unaware. Peter is like this really nice guy. And he comes from like a pretty affluent family. Mm-hmm. And apparently Glenn was like, you know, this guy's really interested in you. I think you should really go out with him. Like, he seems to really like you. And she's like, okay. And the two hit it off. Eventually they get married.
She only went out with him because she got Glenn's approval.
I mean, I think she did a lot of things because of Glenn. Again, because he's so manipulative. Carmen and Peter Holm ended up getting married. Now, shortly after they get married, Peter and Carmen... Carmen and Peter decide to go out for a hike in a place called Pacific, Missouri. And there's, like, this whole network of, like, caves and cliffs. And it's, like, a cool little... Mm-hmm. Like, a sort of, like, a state park area to go to. Now... Carmen had, like, walked out there with this, like, huge purse, like a big tote bag.
Because you need that while you're
hunting. And she goes, I don't know why I brought this. I'm just going to run back to the car real quick and put it back. Like, this is stupid. I'm not going to take this huge purse with me hiking. And he's like, I mean, yeah.
Was she a virgin hiker?
I don't know. I wouldn't bring a giant purse.
Okay.
So she turns back around. She goes and brings it back to the car. She shuts the car door. She's coming back and Peter's there waiting for her. And while she was on her back, she states she heard a loud bang. And when she ran over to Peter, she started screaming because she found that Peter had been shot in the chest.
What?
Yeah. So he fell to the ground and unfortunately he died.
Oh,
right there.
No.
Now,
if you didn't bring your purse hiking, you would have never left his side.
Right. Exactly. So investigators show up at the scene and immediately they notice that there's like this big rock wall sort of right by where Glenn was shot. And on the other side
you
of that
Peter,
rock wall,
Peter
sorry,
shot.
Peter. Yes, Peter. Now, there were like cans strung up like and hanging from a branch like if somebody was shooting like for target practice. Mm-hmm. And there was a big X in tape on the rock wall there with like bullet holes around it. So what it looked like was there was like someone there like range shooting, target practicing. Yeah. And this was not entirely uncommon in the area. A lot of people had guns. A lot of people did target practice like in the woods around there. So it was not a long shot by any means. So they also found a rifle a little ways away, which appeared at the time to have been the murder weapon. And they also found a half-empty bottle of Boone's Farm wine.
Boone's Farm, that was around then?
I know, I know. It's been forever, dude. So investigators concluded that,
drunken,
you know,
shooting.
Yeah, well, exactly. What they thought was that, you know, somebody was target shooting and, you know, Peter was just walking and he ended up walking inadvertently into right into that range. So maybe, you know, and then the person noticed. I know. Sorry, Carmen. So investigators noticed, though, that there's only like 3 shots fired at the targets, which is a little bizarre. Like this whole range that was set up was like brand new and there were like barely any shots around it, which like, okay, maybe somebody. No. So also the rifle that they found had a scope.
I don't know what that means.
So the scope is mounted onto a rifle for aiming purposes. And it's the thing, like a barrel-shaped thing that you see people, like, in the movies. They hold up a rifle, and then they look through this thing with the crosshairs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So unless you're just, like, woo, and, like, waving the rifle around, not even aiming for target practice, you would be using the scope that's mounted on the gun, in theory.
Okay.
So that makes the accidental shooting kind of really unlikely
because you have the scope
on. You have a scope on something, you know exactly what you're shooting at.
So they saw Peter and shot him.
Well, in theory, yeah. So
I guess
it, what it did though, it was, is what it gave off the vibe that this whole thing was maybe staged. Because
the target field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing was staged.
Yeah.
So they bagged everything up and they sent it for testing. Carmen was obviously hysterical while everything was going on. So she was moved to the police car and she was interviewed. And she just stated, I don't know. I was coming back from putting my purse in the car and he was shot. And she denies knowing of anyone who would ever want to hurt him. And she denies knowing anything else about what happened. So as news traveled of this, you know, the town is pretty small. Ruth gets
number one and number
two. Number two.
Okay. Well, there's
gets hold of this. I know there's two of them. So Ruth, the current wife, gets wind of this and she talks to Glenn, who is like, what? You're kidding me. Like shocked.
Wow.
That's the exact sound that he made. Yes. 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 It's exactly.
I'm sure he played it off all theatrical.
Oh, he was very theatrical.
Oh, my Lord.
Yes. And he insisted on, I have to go to her. I have to go to Carmen and I have to comfort her because she must be so beside herself. And he talks as the wife is like, no, like there's like an active like investigation into what happened. Like you can stay here with me, who's your actual wife. And he's like, you're so insensitive. Like, she just lost her husband. What's wrong with you? Like, totally gaslighting the shit out of her. So she's like, fine, go be with Carmen. And of course he did. He left and he went to hang out with Carmen. So again, that's the dynamic.
Douche canoe.
Ruth is like, there is something off about the relationship between these two. I don't know what's going on, but it is super smelly.
I mean, supervisor.
It is smelly.
Like, it's stinky.
The lab processes the evidence. That was found on the scene. Now, the gun was confirmed to have been the one that had killed Peter. And they also noted that the serial number on the gun matched a weapon that was stolen during a burglary weeks prior, which was interesting. And also, they noted that the gun, the bullet, and the wine bottle had all been wiped clean of fingerprints.
Not an accident.
Not an accident. There's absolutely no way. Not that this accident. Was not staged.
It's like they shot him and polished it.
Exactly. No, that would not have happened. So if somebody was actually like tipsy and shooting and accidentally shot someone and then took off, you don't take the time to wipe your fingerprints off of everything. You just don't. So very super sus, not just target practice. It sounded like they really knew what they were doing. And so they started looking into like the organized crime stuff because all of this is still happening in the city, you know?
Yeah.
So they couldn't really find any actual connection. But unfortunately, around this time, these incidents, these shootings, like this violence was so rampant that the police departments could barely even keep up with everything that was going on. And a lot of these crimes like just went unsolved or uninvestigated. They couldn't
investigation that
they yeah deserved. There were entire investigations that didn't even happen because the everything was just so chaotic.
Wow.
And it was so unsafe in the city at the time. So now they did find when they started investigating that the neighbors reported lots of arguments between Peter and Carmen.
Aww.
Yeah. So they had just gotten married. Mm-hmm. And like, by all accounts, you know, they seemed happy. But the neighbors are like, they fight a lot.
I heard some stuff.
Yeah, they fight like a lot. So a little weird. And then the cops start to question, like, the acquaintances, everybody who knows her. And then obviously she's close with Glenn. So Glenn gets an interview. And the cops.
Sure, that's what he wanted.
Oh, it is. Listen to this. So the cops noted that, like, during questioning, he declined knowing anything, but he acted kind of like pompous and like he was hiding something and he was like proud of it. And he would like smirk at them and like look at them like, And then, like, shortly after the police talked with him, they went back to talk with Carmen, only to find that she had, like, checked herself into a psychiatric facility and lawyered up. And she was being advised by everyone to not speak to the investigators anymore. So
stinks for her.
I know. So after all of this, after 10 years of marriage, Ruth had finally had enough and she filed for divorce from Glenn. So
she's still sleeping.
That's
with him
the
too,
end.
Like,
probably. I mean, everything there is so weird. So, meanwhile, Glenn's practice is still like very much on board the struggle bus.
For
right.
The last, so at this point, guys,
years.
Like,
oh, he's
decades.
Barely keeping it afloat, yeah. And he's keeping it afloat like by the very skin of his teeth. No, you know, no pun intended. And he's still being hounded for money. Like from a lot of different vendors. From there was all these attempts at like keeping his practice open. And remember Sophie Barrera, who he borrowed $14,000. Yeah, so she's really starting to pester him for the money back. At this point, it has been years.
I was gonna say
literal years, and she has not seen it. Debt is mounting, and she finally files a lawsuit to get her funds back.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So the man's in trouble.
He is in trouble. He's like really, you know, he's like, shit, now what do I do? So the year is 1981. Glenn is working on a patient in his office and he's drilling on a guy. And all of a sudden he hears this loud bang outside of his office. And he puts down his drill and he says, okay, let me go check.
You don't want to surprise someone with a drill.
You don't want to do
that.
You don't want to do that. I don't think he was all that surprised. And he leaves his patient. He says, I'll be right back. And he goes and looks outside and he sees this car in front of his office that had completely exploded.
Oh,
obviously a car bomb went off, mm-hmm. and so much so that the car was split in two pieces.
Oh.
It was split completely down the middle. The thing was completely ablaze. It was literally right in front of his office. So a crowd obviously starts to form and everyone's like, ah, there's literally, so there, this is the one gory part. There are like belongings and body parts and car parts like raining from the sky. Like this was like a big explosion.
Oh.
So obviously there was a person inside the car.
Oh.
So police start, they go there, they secure the scene and they start picking
office.
Right outside his office. They start picking things up. They start collecting some items, including some clothing and some jewelry. Now, Sophie Barrera's son happened to be in the crowd. And he goes, oh, my God, that's my mom's jewelry.
Stop it.
Yeah. So that it was then that it started coming together that Sophie Barrera was the one that was in the car. Yes. And can you imagine how traumatic? Like, there are literal body parts, like, scattered. And like realizing it's your mom because you recognize some of her stuff. Can you imagine? That's so sad. So
right outside his freaking office.
Yes. So police are like, this was a car bomb. This is Sophie's car, and Sophie was in the car when the bomb went off. So
I'm sure they thought this was mafia too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen to this. So again, a lot of these things were happening around town and not everything got solved and not everything even got investigated because of the sheer volume of stuff that was going on. Now, they initially...
The person who files a lawsuit against him just so happens to die in a car bomb outside of his office.
I know.
No one thought to say, hey.
It gets even more sus. Hold on.
Come on.
They did try to, like, find an actual connection between her and any mafia members. They could not identify anything. So they were like, this seems a little bit more random.
Right.
Like, this does not really seem... Hello. Like, she really did not have any mafia connections whatsoever. So this is the sad thing. Now, 2 weeks prior, Sophie called police from her house because she noticed a wet trash bag in her garage, like right inside the garage door. When she opened it, she found what looked to be a homemade bomb that was like smoking and sizzling. Like it had tried to like discharge and not gone off. It failed. Exactly. So she called the cops. It was so common. Again, it was just totally written off as like mafia activity. And they were like, sorry, like move, I guess. I don't know what to tell you. And she listen to this. She knew exactly who it was.
Right.
She said this guy, Glennon Engelman, put this in my garage, and she confided in her son. She said, Glenn put this bomb in my garage. If anything happens to me, it was Glenn. Tell them it was Glenn. She said those exact words.
Good. So he did.
So then right, 2 weeks please. Later, this has happened. Her son is like, hi, this is what my mom said, and this is what happened like 2 weeks ago. We need to all be looking at this guy.
He chose like the perfect time frame with all this mafia shit going around to use this as a cover. Where
exactly. So investigators noticed that bomb and the bomb that was in the car and the bomb found at the garage weeks prior had been made the exact same way, like manufactured the exact same way, like essentially mm-hmm. identical bomb. So Sophie was killed 6 days before the first court appearance for the lawsuit was supposed to take place. Yeah, exactly. So obviously,
hello.
That was all to try to get her money back. Now, when investigators were talking to Glenn, again, he was arrogant, he was proud, he was a pompous asshole, and he just totally rubbed them all the wrong way. He was smirking and he seemed to just be basking in the attention. He Bastard. Fucking loved it. He loved it. Now, they were very suspicious of him.
I would hope so.
And they started really honing in on him. They reached out to ex-wife Ruth, number two.
Okay.
The second Ruth, okay? And she was cooperative. Initially, she was a little reluctant, but she started admitting and she started talking to the cops. And when the cops, you know, started to really build a rapport with her, she said, you know, I what I'm really nervous about is being Glenn's next victim.
Ugh.
And like...
Right, yeah.
She starts spilling this elaborate tale of Glenn and all of his connections with the mafia, which nobody knew he had.
Except for her
and Glenn. And all of the mafia wars going on, Glenn had direct ties and even family members that were involved with the mafia.
What?
And this whole, like, scheme to, like, start his own practice was the plan... was for it to be like a source of money laundering and a front for him, because what he wanted to do was be some sort of fancy fucking mob boss,
right?
And be this like higher up in the mafia and be
dishing out all the money.
Yeah. And she said he idolized like the Hollywood idea of mob bosses and hitmen and all of that. He loved all of that wanted that life.
Almost like was it Sinatra?
That's exactly what it was like. So Ruth starts sharing again. Glenn has never had a problem that he could not fix with murder. And we are going to talk about some of the stories that she tells about what Glenn has done.
So she knew that Glenn had murdered people.
100%. Yeah.
Prior to the divorce.
Mm-hmm. She says, you guys, he has killed a lot of people and he will keep killing whoever he needs to. And she tells some stories.
What?
So we're going to talk about the first story. So
Ruth.
I know, Ruth. So she tells us that back in 1963, he had a business associate by the name of Eric Fry. And the two of them were working on some like get rich quick scheme to open a drag racing strip.
Okay.
Which is like random, like a dentist, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's what they wanted to do at the time. This is in 1963, and apparently that was like a big industry. So Eric Fry had contributed about $16,000 of his own money to invest in this business venture. And while he and Engelman went to visit the construction site, Eric at one point was struck with a rock in the head and fell into this open well, like this big hole in the ground.
Convenient.
And subsequently, a stick of dynamite goes off
no.
in that hole, and he was killed.
Why did he want him killed?
So The incident was all investigated, and Eric's death was ruled an accident. Now, Fry's widow did collect a life insurance policy. His widow was an ex-girlfriend of Engelman's.
Stop it.
Yeah. So, Ruth claims that Glenn killed Eric and the two of them split the insurance payout.
Oh, my freaking word.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Even though he had already given him that money.
Yep.
He's worth more dead.
Yep. All these people worth more dead than alive. It just gets more chaotic.
Oh, boy.
I know.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So, another story. Engelman has this steamy love affair with this woman named Barbara Guswell Boyle, okay? So, he works his, like, gross woman magnet, like, magic on her. And again, starts manipulating the shit out of her. And he somehow manipulates her into marrying this guy named Ronald Guswell. And she didn't, like, even care about this guy. Like, she didn't know about this guy. Now, Ronald Guswell's family was very rich, and they owned an oil company. And she's like, I don't care about this guy. I don't care about this guy, Ronald, whatever. In 1977, Ronald's parents, Arthur and Vernita Guswell, were murdered in their farmhouse, which was in Edwardsville, Illinois. Arthur was shot, and Vernita was bludgeoned to death.
What?
Yep. Now, their son, Ronald...
becomes the heir.
He becomes the heir, right? Mm-hmm. 17 months later, he dies.
No kidding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, his widow, who's Barbara Guswell Boyle, uh-huh. was set to collect millions in life insurance, and she is now the proprietor of the, you know, he was company. The sole heir of yeah. the oil company, so now that all belongs to her. So... Barbara, though, there was an investigation, and Barbara was convicted of killing her husband.
No.
So they found out that Barbara was the one that killed
but
her husband.
Not that Glenn was involved.
She was acquitted of, she was suspected of murdering the parents, but was acquitted of that. At this point, Glenn had not been suspected to be involved at all. It was all her. So there, you know, they together received a huge insurance payout. And Barbara was sentenced to 50 years for killing her husband.
But then that means Glenn didn't get a dime.
Glenn didn't get a dime. Well,
she's charged, right? She doesn't get the money.
I think he did. It says that he did. How? I don't know how, but he did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is like in the 1970s. So I don't think that like insurance companies were that.
No one could freeze your bank account.
Nobody. Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, she, you know, they just pulled the wool, cashed in really quick before the like questions started getting asked about his death, and they split it. And then he was like, hey, F you, lady. And she took the fall for most of it.
Wow.
So that's another story. So here's a third story.
I was going to say, how many more you got?
Ruth number one. Do you remember Ruth number one? Ruth, 3-year Ruth. It only lasted 3 years. So... now, Ruth, after she and Glenn split up, you know how they stayed together and were banging and, you yeah. know, doing all the gross stuff together.
Yeah.
So she moves on and she marries a guy named James Stanley Bullock. He's a 27-year-old guy, really nice guy. And he, I guess, was working as a clerk for an electric company. He was studying to become an accountant. And the two got married and seemingly were happy. Now, 5 months after they get married... they were on out on a date at, so they were out on a date near the St. Louis Art Museum, and James was attacked in the street and shot by a masked man. And unfortunately he died. Now he had an insurance policy of $64,000, which Ruth collected. Unfortunately, after an investigation, no charges were filed on the murder of James Bullock at all because there was just no
Who
evidence
was the
of anything.
Man, they didn't know.
They didn't know. So Ruth, first wife, and Glenn split the insurance money.
What the hell?
Now, she was never prosecuted for her involvement due to lack of evidence in any of this. Like, even after it came out, none of this. So... Ruth says that many of these people had hits out on them through the mafia. Also, like the people that he's killed in the past, and he would just like plan and arrange their deaths. And he was like living this mobster, hitman, mafia
dream.
And investigators were like, lady, this is a lot. So they had work to be done to prove any of this, especially because some of these crimes were like lots of years old at this point, and had cold. And a lot of them had been cold or ruled as accidents because he was just so good at his job. Now, initially, they were like, we really need you to testify. We need an eyewitness account for any of this to work.
Uh-oh.
She was terrified. She's like, I don't want to be assassinated, you guys. I don't want the next one to be me. So the cops tell her, listen, we're going to do everything we can to protect you. He will go to jail forever if you wear a wire and you get him to confess to some of this stuff. So she was obviously terrified of wearing a wire.
Did they have witness protection back then?
Well, I think probably to an extent. But still, like, this is the mafia we're talking about. If they want someone dead, like, no witness protection is going to help that. So she obviously was terrified, but they hatched this plan to wire up a room instead of her, because she knew that, like, if he found a wire on her, he would just, like, kill her. She'd be dead. So they put a bunch of microphones. They mic'd up, like, her bedroom, and they were like, okay, like, get him in your bedroom and get him to talk. So
yeah, but this is not the ex-wife the effort, sleeping with.
The effort this woman went to.
Oh.
So police were like, listen, when you're talking to him, like, focus on the most recent crime. Focus on Sophie's murder. If you can just get him to admit that he was behind Sophie's murder, then that will be enough for us to at least get him put away. Ruth, A for effort, Ruth, on this part. So
number two.
She calls him up and she's like, hey, big boy, you want to come over?
God.
And he's like, yeah, I do. And so he comes over and they go into the bedroom and they start doing the stuff.
Stop.
And she tells him, God, she is not smooth with this, though. Like, she leaves a lot to be desired. Not a police woman. She goes, I want to know all your secrets.
Oh, please.
And he replies, oh, you mean Sophie? That stupid bitch deserved to die.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but that's not a confession yet.
And then she replies with, again, Ruth. Oh,
did you do it?
She goes, you mean you have no remorse about killing people? And then he starts getting suspicious. Like, why the hell would you say that to me? Like, that's a weird question. Why would you ask me that? I've never killed anyone. You're making me think that this room is bugged.
What?
And so she's like,
oh, no. Ah. Oh, no.
And he starts, like, trying to get physical with her. Like he, like, shakes her. But she just, like, reined that shit right back in. And she was like, hell no. And then they just, like, start having sex. And they had sex. And then she was like, I'm not going to push the issue anymore because he's already suspicious. So they let that to rest. So she's willing to try again. This time around, though, she had a lot more success. So what they did was they put a wire on her. And then the two of them are meeting in a coffee shop. So
if he doesn't confess in bed, he's going to confess in public.
Well, he did, weirdly enough. I don't know what it was about the environment.
Okay.
But he just, like, starts spilling it. And what he said that was, like, really striking was, you can be intimate with anyone, but the best feeling ever is when you can be homicidally intimate with someone.
What? That is so creepy.
I know, it's so weird. What? Meanwhile, the person who, like, is sleeping with him, she's like, this is fucking weird.
Oh, my God.
I know. So,
and he just thinks he's all that because his ex-wives keep coming back.
And part of what was caught on that, too, is what he had said, what he was talking about Carmen. And he started talking about some of her involvement because, remember, Carmen's husband was killed. So he said, I remembered.
Was Carmen involved in that? That's why she brought the fucking purse. She's not stupid.
She ain't stupid.
Oh.
So, well, she is because he manipulated the shit out of all of these people. Can you believe how many women helped him do this stuff? I mean, this is bonkers. It's bonkers. So he said, I remembered a morning at work. Carmen and I were so connected that I knew she was on my wavelength, and Carmen and I decided to find a victim together. And then he goes on to describe that she married Peter on purpose, using her charm, and all of it was a plan to kill him and split the insurance money. I know. All of this time that they spent together, when, like, Glenn and Carmen were together, they were not having a physical relationship. They were not having an affair. They were just discussing and planning and conniving Peter's murder and making this whole ass plan. Right?
I'm so lost.
So this was just his pattern of finding these young, vulnerable, gullible women and convincing them to help him concoct all of these murder plans just to like make a bunch of money. And for a lot of these women who like didn't have a whole lot else, like, you know, $30,000 sounds fucking amazing back then. You know what I mean? Like that's like life changing.
Did
you know,
he got caught. I mean, we have the story about him. So
after this recording confession, after this whole recorded confession, Glennon Engelman was arrested and charged with capital murder.
Capital murder.
Yeah. So Carmen made a deal with investigators that her charges would be dropped if she were to be a star witness in the case. And they really needed her to win the case. So they were like, okay. So she never got charged with anything, but she testified on the stand and she provided them with a lot of information about what happened. So the trial starts in June of 1980. It took the jury 10 days to deliberate after they heard everything.
Why'd you need that long?
Well,
was it just on Peter's case or all of them together?
No, I think there was more than one because he was convicted. He was convicted of murdering Sophie and also Peter.
Okay,
I believe.
So,
while incarcerated, he confessed his involvement in the deaths of the Goosewell family. You know, the two parents. She killed the husband. So the what?
Right, but did he confess that he was involved?
He killed the two parents himself. So he was convicted of those murders as well. He was imprisoned and was serving multiple life sentences.
Good.
So he loved the chase, the planning and the killing. And after his conviction, he shared that he was planning several more murders in the future as well. And if he hadn't been caught, he would have killed like a lot more people. He had made, after like they calculated everything, he had made over $500,000.
Yeah, I mean, you could have just paid her back instead of killed her.
Yeah, I just...
I mean, that's not even 10%.
I feel like he was hemorrhaging so much money that was like... I mean, his practice stayed quote-unquote afloat for that long because he just burned through all of this.
He's an idiot.
So he is a self-proclaimed sociopath. So he has never been treated... He has never been treated or diagnosed. So we're going to talk a little bit about sociopathy because I've always found it really interesting. So sociopathy is a term that's used to describe someone who suffers from antisocial personality disorder, right? Okay. So antisocial personality disorder is a pattern of socially irresponsible, exploitive, and guiltless behavior that often begins in childhood or early adolescence. And it's manifested by disturbances in many aspects of life, like many and all aspects of life. Mm-hmm. So it's most common in males. The cause is really unknown, but there's some research that suggests that there is a genetic component, but there's also a situational component. Like
that triggers it.
Yeah, yeah. Like it seems to be more prevalent in young males that have experienced like a trauma in their life, who they've been abused or sexually mm-hmm. abused. And or that have been transplanted and have been in the system. There's that as well. So these are some of the characteristic behaviors. So failure to conform to the law, failure to sustain consistent employment, manipulation of others for personal gain, failure to develop stable interpersonal relationships, and a pattern of complete disregard for the rights of others. I feel like tick, 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 tick. Most people that have this are not dangerous people. There is a misconception that all of these people are like, you know, automatically serial killers. So serial killers are a rare breed all around, even for people with this disorder. But people that have this, they are more prone to committing violent crimes. Mm-hmm. They just are, statistically speaking. And most people that have this disorder just like go on to be successful business people or politicians or salespeople, and they can have a fulfilling life.
The characteristics of not caring about others.
So well, that's the thing. Yeah,
themselves first. Who cares? Exactly. Who they ruin on their way.
Exactly.
To the top.
And people with this disorder describe like an utter lack of remorse for their actions or for the suffering of others, and they only have this drive and desire for personal gain, and that's literally it in their life. So they describe like there's like an overall lack of understanding of normal human emotions. So some even become really skilled at hiding their disease and working really hard to fit in with society and learning how others react to certain situations, how others display emotions, and mimicking that.
Trying to adapt to normal being behavior.
But disingenuously. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
So I suspect that all that whole charitable like facade that this guy put on
was a front.
It was him putting himself out there in a certain light in order to be able to have the lifestyle that he wanted.
Absolutely.
So because of the nature of the disease, it's very difficult to identify and very difficult to treat. And typically it's not even identified until, you know, this person ends up in some sort of treatment following an incident of some kind. And people with antisocial personality disorder often, they actually are more likely to die at a young age due to accidental deaths, drug overdoses, suicides, and even homicides.
Yeah. I can understand that.
And a lot of notorious serial killers have been suspected or formally diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, such as John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, and Charles Manson. Interesting stuff.
And now Glenn.
And now Glenn. Although, again, he's self-proclaimed. Right. I couldn't find anything that said he was formally diagnosed. But if you read through the characteristics, to me, it all seems to really fit.
He self-proclaims it.
Well, I think...
To put himself in that category with these other series.
Probably. Yeah, he probably just... To elevate himself, to make himself more relevant, more interesting.
If I'm going to be in prison for life, exactly. I'm going to have a name for myself.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was a big part of it. And so, now, March of 1999, Glenn was found dead in his cell. And presumably the cause was complications of diabetes. He had very long-standing type 2 diabetes, and he had a lot of complications from that.
He didn't deserve a natural death.
No.
Just
no.
Saying.
He deserved a lot of suffering. I hope he suffered.
I hope so.
Yep. I hope he suffered in jail. I hope he got a lot of shit in jail.
Certainly.
I hope he had a miserable ass time. Oh, and that is the chaotic mess of a story of Glennon Engelman, the dastardly dentist Patreon pick that we've covered.
Thanks, Patreon, for at least choosing one that's a little less gory.
Oh, I know.
Last week was a lot for me.
It really was. Devin is like barely recovering from all of that. Also, I want to say another thank you to Emily Taylor for being our fifth Patreon. I just feel like...
Yes.
Also,
Emily, this is your episode. This one's for you.
This one's for you, girlfriend. And also, I haven't assigned her like a woodland creature yet.
Right.
Fairy! She's a fairy.
Yeah.
Yes!
Okay, there you go.
She's a fairy. We love you, Emily. Also...
And to our other Patreons, we don't disregard you either.
Oh, hell no.
You guys are amazing.
You guys are our best friends.
Yes. We thank all of you, each and every one of you, from our first to our fifth.
We love you all so much.
Soon, one day it'll be the hundreds.
I know. Wouldn't that be great? Oh, awesome, man. That would be amazing.
You guys were the top five.
Oh, God. We love you guys so much. And we genuinely have so much fun doing this, and we hope you guys enjoy. And again, feedback is key. Yeah. Give us the feedback. We need it. We love it.
I enjoy seeing the numbers and seeing the people listening. And it's
100%.
Cool.
It is really cool.
It's pretty cool.
All right. So if you guys want to drop us a follow on Instagram, you can find us at MedCrimes Podcast. You can search us on Twitter. Send us a Twitter at MedCrimes PC, or you can find us on Facebook by searching MedCrimes Podcast. And if you wish to become a Patreon and participate in our giveaway, slot number six is open. Six is also a good round number.
That is a round number. Yes, you caught on.
Again, that was an expression. I know that five isn't a round number. I know that. But anyway, www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. Keep us going, bitches.
Thanks, guys. Till next time.
Bye.